طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. Again this week, we have an original feature presentation that will fill our entire time. Israeli human rights attorney Michael Sfard spoke at the Harvard Hillel Society in Cambridge, and we were there to record it for This Week in Palestine. Sfard is one of those unique attorneys obsessed with a passion to represent those in society being abused by the system, which in his society is the Palestinians. But he is quick to say that in so doing he is striving to save the soul of his country, Israel. Only a just society for everyone is acceptable to him, and that is what he strives to achieve. Michael Sfard is the author of the recently published book, The Wall and the Gate, which examines the ethics and challenges of legal work for human rights. Recounting key cases and issues, Sfard lays bare the reality of the occupation and exposes its surreal legal structures. With emotional force and penetrating analysis, he offers both a moral reckoning with the occupation and a blueprint for a hopeful future. The presentation is in the form of a conversation with two of the Harvard community, Professor Arthur Applebaum of the JFK School of Government and Harvard undergraduate Isabel Slavinsky. Each will ask Sfard questions which will stimulate the conversation. Here is Israeli human rights attorney Michael Sfard, beginning with a question from Professor Applebaum.
You detail in this book all sorts of very, very reflective internal struggles about what it's like to be a human rights lawyer for a cause in a situation where the actual victories are few and far between. And to actually put a very almost tragic point on it, sometimes you feel as if you're actually serving almost as supporting or enabling a situation that you're trying to end. And I understand that this is one of the most important motivations in writing the book, was to try to grapple with this and present to us how you think through those various problems. So can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I needed 470 pages in order to figure out what I think about this question. First, I have to say, I'm used to speaking before to audiences, but I have to say that I'm really excited, and I want to thank the sponsors of this evening. I want to thank you too, and each and every one of you that attended here. I understand that this is not considered to be a very cold day in Cambridge, but I admire you. For me, I didn't feel my ears. I didn't know that I'm going to be a lawyer or that I'm going to study law until I actually went to Hebrew University with an objective to register myself to a different to computer science, and found myself filling the form and getting law as my first priority. But since the day I decided to be a lawyer, it was clear to me that I want to do human rights work and to be a cause lawyer. And since I decided that, it was clear to me as an Israeli that I have to lend whatever talent that I have and energy that I have and resources that I have to fight to end the occupation over the Palestinian territories. It was clear to me because the Israeli occupation is the most massive abuse of human rights that stems over decades and affects millions of people who are stripped of their civil rights, who are subjected to a regime that they have not elected, and most importantly, a regime that even in among a few, there were times when one could think that this that the Israeli government wants to go through a path that will lead to an end to the occupation. It is quite clear now that this is not the case. I said before in a very exciting meeting with some Hillel activists here that if I had to litigate a case to prove the bad faith of the government of Israel in ending, in aspiring to end the occupation, that would be my easiest case ever. So it was clear to me that this is what I want to do, and I thought that it's a very simple principle that could lead my professional life. And the decision-making is very simple, too. I will represent Palestinians who are victims of practices and policies applied by the Israeli army, abused by Israeli settlers, and I will litigate and ask for remedy from the Israeli courts for them. Now, I think if I try to trace back where the dilemma or the doubts that I'm doing the right thing began, so probably it began with the first case I lost. But it matured and became a real question in the first case that I won. Now, since lawyers tend to forget the cases they lost, and I'm not sure there was one, I can talk about one case that I remember. It's not the first case that I won, but a case that I won that was considered to be a big victory. It was a case that I was retained by the village council of the council of the village of Pilin, small community at the outskirts of Ramallah. No Israeli knew the name Pilin before they began their struggle against the separation fence. To be honest, not many Palestinians knew of that place. But then the separation barrier that Israel erected took more than half of their lands, their farmlands, and they began a campaign to dismantle the fence and free their walled-off farmlands. And they did it in a very creative, non-violent way, shoulder-to-shoulder with Israeli peace activists and internationals who came there too. And at a certain point, they retained me, and I litigated their case in the Israeli Supreme Court. And our argument was just like the argument all around the fence, barrier, wall, you choose the term, cases, is A, that the whole project was a manipulation of the Israeli justified concern of terrorist attacks that inflicted Israeli towns and cities, and the desire of Israelis to create some kind of a barrier that would stop terrorists from coming into the country. But then Prime Minister Sharon, who was a big admirer of Greater Israel and wanted to get as much land as possible from the West Bank, has designed a route that would basically that would invade into the West Bank rather than go on the acknowledged internationally acknowledged borders, eastern border, that is the Green Line, the Armistice Lines of 1949. And so the route of the fence was a route that walled off about six. The planned route was walled off by more than 16% of the West Bank, harming 150 Palestinian villages and hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were living off that of these lands. So the first argument was this is an illegal enterprise. It's illegal under international law to build, to erect such a barrier inside a occupied land. The second was that the argument that this route was chosen according to security needs was bogus. It was a mirage. And actually, wanted to serve the expansionist desires of the settlement project. We won that case. We won that case big time. The court has acknowledged that the route was not serving security means, but rather interests, but rather the expansion of nearby settlements. And it ordered to reroute the fence. Now, in the time that we were litigating the case, some construction has been done. So the court ordered the fence to be relocated to the end, to the perimeter of where the nearby houses of the nearby settlement were already erected. And so what it meant in practice was that the village will get half of its land back. I came that day to the village. There was such a festival there. People were singing and dancing, and there was food, and media and journalists from all around the world were there, and people were genuinely very happy. And I saw people being interviewed and declaring victory. On my way back, I thought to myself, so what did I accomplish today? The village is happy in first of all, I did restore, we restored, in this case, lands to their rightful owners. And later on, in the first season that I got olive oil that was created through these liberated lands, it was the most moving foodstuff I've ever gotten. But at the same time, they lost half of their lands. And I thought to myself, they are acting like this Hasidic that went to the rabbi and asked, you know, we're living with five children in a small one-bedroom apartment. We can't live, we don't have space to breathe, there's no privacy. And the rabbi says, well, buy a goat, put it in your house. He said, what, rabbi? He said, do it and come back in a week. And when he comes back after a week, he says, rabbi, what have you done? It's impossible, I can't live like that. He says, now take it, go out, and you'll see how big your apartment is. And this is what Pinning went through. They suddenly got only half of their lands back, but they felt jubilated. And the international media wrote that there is justice in Jerusalem, that the court has provided these poor Palestinians with real justice. So I went back home thinking all the way. On the one hand, we restored land to their rightful owners. There are actual people, families, whose life is easier now, is better off. On the other hand, my goal as a human rights lawyer is not only to serve my clients. Yes, it's the first and foremost, the most important thing, and my allegiance and my ethics, professional ethics, oblige me to do everything according to the law that I am allowed to do in order to secure my clients' interests. But at the same time, as an activist, as a legal activist, I want to promote a change. I want to bring about, to contribute to the ending of this massive abuse of human rights, which is called the occupation. Now, has this case prolonged the shelf life of the occupation or shortened it? These are the type of questions that began crippling in me. And that is why I decided that when I have the time, I will try to delve into this and try to learn from the vast experience of more than 4.5 decades of litigation in the Israeli court on cases, on human rights issues that stem from the Israeli control over millions of Palestinians. And throughout the years, until I had the opportunity to put some, to dedicate some time for researching and writing the book, I was, every time that I came back from Jerusalem on the highway, in the Jerusalem Tel Aviv highway, after a hearing, after litigating, after unwinding from the tension that is related to litigating a case, I would have these belly aches, asking myself, am I a naive collaborator of that system that enables, with all good intentions, enables my government, who I very fiercely critique, and who I have a huge disagreement with, and who I think is leading my country and my society to the abyss, to the moral abyss. Am I only helping, aiding in some way to this by providing an aura of legality, rule of law, and the notion that the power and the force used against Palestinians is not arbitrary. So these are very, very profound questions. I called it, in an article I wrote, I called it the human rights lawyer's existential dilemma. Because if the answer is, yes, I am, then I have to retire and do something else. So that's my long answer to your question.
So moving toward the separation barrier and other legal cases about it, can you talk a bit about the laws, the permit system that addresses how you can travel in the steam zone, and then the court cases surrounding it and the outcome?
Yeah. So, as I mentioned before, I think the erecting the separation barrier, I say something about terminology. It's a 700 kilometers long set of fences, barbed wire fences, and walls. And this is why some call it wall and some call it fence. To be honest, it's mainly fences. Only in the urban areas it's walls. And these walls and fences have the same characteristic that any wall and fence have. They are stupid. They do not distinguish between men or women, whites or blacks, Jews or Palestinians. So in order to have this, and of course on the other side of the wall, I call it barrier, this is easier. On the other side of the barrier, the separation barrier, there are two communities. There is the majority who are Palestinians, and there is the minority who are Jewish settlers, Israeli settlers. And so this system needs some kind of a more sophisticated apparatus to, pardon my language, to select who can cross it and who cannot. And that is the legal barrier. The legal barrier that is built on top of the physical barrier is what we call the permit system. It's a declaration, a military declaration of the whole area between the barrier and the green line, which is called the seam zone, as a closed military area, which means that anyone who wants to enter, no one is allowed to enter unless they have a permit from the military commander to enter the seam zone, and whoever is there must get out unless they get a permit from the military commander. Now, the declaration, when it was signed in 2002, embarrassingly included a clause saying that Israelis are exempted from the declaration. The declaration does not apply to Israelis, so they can enter without getting a permit. Now, Israelis was defined in the same declaration as one of the following three: a national of the state of Israel, a citizen, a permanent resident of the state of Israel, and any person who has a right to become a citizen of the state of Israel according to the law of return. So that means that while Palestinians who live in this area for generations, whose parents, grandparents, great-great-grandparents have lived there, need to get a permit in order to keep on living in their homes, any yeshiva bucher from Brooklyn can climb over the fence. It doesn't affect him, or I wanted to say, or her. So I litigated a case against the permit system, and that was a very difficult case emotionally, because for the first time in an Israeli court, maybe not, yeah, I think it was the first time, the word apartheid was mentioned, and I know that this is a very contentious word, and I'm a person of words, and I do not take words lightly. I think many, many times before I use certain words. But when I looked into this, and I, by the way, rejected, in 2002, when they began building the wall, many pro-Palestinian groups already called it the apartheid wall. And I objected that. I said, you know, not every murder is a genocide, and not every discrimination is an apartheid. We should be very careful with words. But I had my doubts, and what lawyers usually do when they have doubts, if they want to explore that, I open the file, and I call it a archive question mark, and I put documents in it. Whenever I came across a document that I thought was relevant to that question, I put it there. And it became quite a big file, and eventually I had a whole PowerPoint presentation that was created by that file. And when I looked into the matter, I couldn't escape that word. And in court, I said that in our arguments, I brought the tax laws of South Africa, which were a set of laws that obligated blacks when they come to white areas to have a permit to be in white areas. And there were all kinds of permits, just like in the sea zone. All kinds of permits, a permit for a merchant, a permit for a doctor, a permit for this and for that. Overnight, not overnight, with vehicle, without vehicle. And when I argued that in court, the then Chief Justice Dorit Benish was clearly uncomfortable, and she said, "Mr. Spart, do we really need that word?" And cheeky of me, I said, "And if we will not use it, will it disappear? Will it go away?" The case ended with a denial of the petition, in the sense that the permit system is still there, although the court has went very, very deeply into the nitty-gritty details of the permit system and tried to make it easier for Palestinians to get a permit and things like that. But this is the kind of case that shows that, on the one hand, we were not successful in the case in principle in eradicating the permit system. By the way, the alternative that we proposed was to have a physical checkup of every person that crosses a checkpoint. May he or she be Jewish, Palestinian, or Swiss. But that was rejected without any explanation. Why is that not a good idea? I can tell you why it's not a good idea. Because the settlers would never agree to stand in lines and be checked every day when they go to work in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. And this is a purely political thing. On the other hand, I felt in that case that one of the main purposes that we human rights lawyers are there for is to, and I said that before so you hear it again in the room, is to articulate and draft and redraft and fine-tune our indictment against the status quo and against the state of affairs. Because there's something about, it's not only lawyers. There are many disciplines and people from many different professions that do that. But lawyers master language, and cause lawyers are injecting into their advocacy values and constitutional principles and morality. And every day when my colleagues and I go to court, every day we fine-tune our allegations against the current situation, and that creates that provides a significant and central part of the manifest for the movement to end the occupation. And I think that I found in that case, which I didn't win, that sometimes you can lose, but losing is not failing, and just like winning is not necessarily being successful. There's a difference between those. It makes perfect sense and for rational beings to think that victory is it brings us to success, and that defeat probably makes us closer to failure. But that's not necessarily so. Sometimes it is so, but many times it's not. Sometimes a defeat can ignite a process that will eventually bring success. And success and failure are notions that are measured by a much long-term process of how the act that you were involved in contributed to changing the discourse, perceptions, and eventually bringing about change.
So, first, I have to correct the factual record. A very, very long time ago, I was a yeshiva bacher, a co-ed yeshiva, and I assure you that there are yeshiva bachurot.
sorry.
I'd like to press you on the civil rights lawyer's existential dilemma. So those of us in the United States who are old enough to remember have lived through at least part of the civil rights movement think with great, great pride about the opportunity in the law and the opportunity in litigation. And American Jews, even those who are on the, you know, share your view about the occupation, nonetheless console themselves in the thought that, well, at least the Israel has a Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court is ruled by law. When I read your book, it sounds as if there are two moods. One mood is a hopeful mood. It's, and you have these little anecdotes. One is Justice Landau, despite himself, he couldn't help it. He had no choice but to agree with human rights lawyers on Elo Moreh, because there's just no way in the face of the evidence that there was no security reason, right? And then at the end, you have and then you have the Justice Minish saying that, you know, Mrs. Farr, do you really think that you'd be able to change politics through litigation? And of course, you have to think that maybe you can. So that there's an optimistic mood. Another part of this optimistic mood is when you, very, very early on, I think 1971, when the Supreme Court first takes jurisdiction and first acknowledges that the international law of occupation is justiciable in Israeli courts, something that they didn't have to do, but they did because that's simply the way that they did it. So there are all these optimistic, hopeful moments that would propel you. But then there's this underlying, this other mood, a kind of a cynical mood. And I want to ask a question not about the existential dilemma for a human rights lawyer, but presumably that follows from what your view is about the courts, about rule of law in Israel. And if you have a very pessimistic view about the possibility of opportunity in the law, that would lead you in one way. But clearly you go back and forth, because sometimes you're a little cynical, and sometimes you're a little snide about the motivations of justices, and other times you're very, very hopeful. You say, well, and again, it's not a matter of winning and losing, but rather you have this enduring hope that in the end, politics will change, but human rights law will be properly applied eventually. So what do you think about the Israeli Supreme Court and the justice system?
I think they're very similar to the Israeli society. I think what you're describing, and well, it's what I described and so well articulated, is a split personality. And I believe that the Israeli society suffers from split personality. We generally have contradicting characteristics. The Israeli society was born on, you know, the ashes of the Holocaust after 2,000 years of persecution and pogroms and so on and so forth, and it was created under the created as a way for the new Jew to be a strong, a winning, a macho, militaristic person. And so it was based on a very fierce nationalism, together with some disregard to the victims of our national project, to the verge of some racism even. And at the same time, and this is where I depart from some of my good friends in the radical left who think that Israel was never had any genuine liberal values in Britain. I disagree. I think that the fact that at the same time that many other nations became independent and did not create democratic institutions, Israel was formed on the idea of an elected legislator and separation of powers and the rule of law and an extreme court that cherished more than anything else and guarded and protected free speech. I think these things, and a plural an academia that has pluralism and the arts that have pluralism, I mean, these are things that you cannot disregard. So these two personalities have been dancing in the Israeli arena for years, and there was some kind of a status quo that was created along the years. But it never actually settled the fight between those two. And what we're seeing in the last decade is basically the the shattering of this status quo and the attempt of one personality to kill his brother. But what we're not seeing, though, a new status quo. What we're seeing is a struggle. What you're seeing, if you open every morning Haaretz, you see a struggle over every little thing. We're in the middle of a struggle, and we have to win that struggle. So the Supreme Court is no different. The Supreme Court has these traits in it. It's not a leftist. Never was. It was never a human rights activist, the Israeli Supreme Court. It was never a pro-Palestinian court. It was never a right-wing, radical, messianic court. It was a court that probably the best predictive parameter for its rulings was the position of the security establishment on the given case. So it was a malachti. It was a one that was. Advancing what it saw as the national interest. And that also is changing now. That also is changing. And Israel's Supreme Court is not the same as it was 10, 15 years ago. It became a court where you have judges that are very nationalistic, that check. It's not just being nationalistic, but it is giving the nationalistic interests more weight than individual freedoms and individual rights. And so this court of today has generated some very troubling rulings that I don't think any other court in our 70-year history would have rendered. So, for example, the court that koshered the anti-boycott law, which makes it a civil wrong for me to now call on you to boycott settlement products. You can think whatever you want on that political position stand. You can agree, you can disagree. But thinking that I have to be sanctioned for trying to convince my fellow citizens or other people to take a non-violent political action and be an ethical consumer. This is probably the lowest point our court has ever reached, I think. And it has koshered many worse things for human rights, but I'm just pointing this because it's about our democratic space, the recession that Stefan quoted Naomi Chazan. And this is very troubling because the rule of law and the respect for human rights is not just something that is good for the people who are the victims of rights abuses. It's probably the most important thing in the stability and the security of a nation. And if people do not understand that this would be the biggest victory of the foes of Israel, then they do not understand what makes a society strong.
So, speaking a little bit about the court's willingness to make decisions about certain issues, can you talk a little bit more about how the court decided or did not decide the issue of the settlements and whether it's legal to have a transfer of populations into the West Bank and its decision not to decide,
yeah,
and the impact on the future of the settlements.
Right. Yeah, when I wrote this section in the book, I thought to myself, we need to sue from the judges to reimburse the Israeli treasury for the salary they got when they decided not to rule on the issue of legality of settlements. All they have only one obligation in their life. They are judges. They are appointed not for life, but until the age of 70 in Israel, and they are immune from anything else. But they have to do one thing, to rule, and they decided not to. The issue of settlements is the most painful issue of all when it comes to the Israeli occupation, because there's a vast difference between in occupation and a colonial occupation. A colonial occupation is one where the occupier is transferring parts of its own population into the occupied territory. Now, what that creates, and it is shown very well in the reality in the West Bank, is that you have two communities. One is rightless, weightless, has not only no voice in the corridors of power where their fate is being decided, but they have completely no connections, no leverage in the authorities. And you have neighbors who are the complete opposite, the mirror picture. They have civil rights, they are represented, they have connections, they have political power. This is a recipe, a sure recipe. Israelis are not worse or not better than anyone else. Any community that would be in such a situation, the community of those who have will start sucking the riches of the territory on the expense of the community that have no rights. And this is what happens in the West Bank. And early on, Israeli civil rights lawyers and human rights lawyers have tried to challenge the legality of the establishment of settlements. And the challenge is quite simple. International humanitarian law, the laws of war, which have a subfield that is called international laws of belligerent occupation, have a very clear principle, prohibition, that knows no exceptions. One of the only prohibitions that know no exceptions. That it is prohibited to transfer population from the occupying power to the occupied territory. Very clear. And the Israeli court has decided in the Bargil case that this is a question that has an answer in law. They didn't say there is no answer in law. It was, I remind you, in the 80s and 90s, we had the most activist court probably in the Western Hemisphere. Probably only the Indian Supreme Court was more active than the Israeli court. And the president of the court later on, President Barak, was known for saying everything is justiciable. Only one thing is not, and that was the settlements. The argument was the issue of the future of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, the issue of settlements, is the one question that divides more than anything else the Israeli public. And hence, it should be decided not in the court, but in politics. But we're a democracy. Democracy will have to decide on that. It's unfit for a court to make a decision on the main question that is being debated by the people. This is a very captivating, very attractive argument. There's only one problem with it, and that is that the only people that court thought should decide on the question are the occupiers. The occupied have no say. And if there's any sacred mission for judges and for the judiciary, which is the only arm of government that is not dependent on public support, it is dependent in general, but not in every case and case, is to give remedy and protection to those who are weakened, who are oppressed. And the Israeli court has failed tragically in that. And at the same time, it failed protecting Israel from itself.
So I'll ask my last question, and Isabel can ask a question and open things up to questions. So you've spoken very, very reflectively about worries that you have and criticisms from the right, from the left, and worrying that maybe you are simply enabling or clamoring. I want you to briefly address a kind of criticism that could come from the right. I know what my answer would be, but I'm curious to know just how you would give your answer. And the answer would be that you are somehow, how to put it, I mean, the harshest way to put it is that you're being disloyal. A less harsh way of putting it is that you're giving comfort to litigants who shouldn't be supported, maybe not on fences, but on house demolitions and deportations. Like that's somehow you're playing into the hands of people who wish Israel ill. How do you respond to those kinds of criticisms?
You mentioned two very different things.
Yes.
One is that you're playing into their hands, which is a mellow
yes.
one. The harsher one was that I'm a fifth column, a traitor, and so on. As for that one, I have to say that the issue of the kind of discourse that says you are doing what you're doing with bad intentions. You want to cause harm to your community, your society, your country, is a kind of discourse that is not expecting an answer, is not expecting an exchange. It expects to delegitimize my work. Because how can I prove that my intentions are good? Even if I'm wrong, and I'm wrong, right? I'm not, but I might be wrong. So how can I, what can I do in order to prove that I mean well? So this kind of discourse is the most damaging one to democracy. And I have to say, I came to New York for my fellowship, for writing this book. I got a fellowship with the Open Society Foundation and moved here for a while. I came here 8 days before, then real estate mogul Donald Trump announced his candidacy to presidency. And I stayed here throughout the primary season and the election season and until the tragic end. And what I saw was a process that I called the Israelization of American discourse. When instead of talking about values, instead of talking about merits and content, people are talking, it's not a discourse, it's an allegation exchange. And that is something that has to be exposed by what it is. There's no way to answer. I cannot go and have a blood test to show you that I mean well. You have to trust me on that. Now, as for the other one, which is much more legitimate, to say that I serve the interests of maybe unintentionally, that I play to the hands of terrorists because I struggle fiercely against house demolitions, which I see, and most of the legal community in Israel sees, as a collective punishment. My answer to that is, terrorism is a terrible thing and very painful thing. But unlike conventional war, until the day the terrorists get unconventional weapons, but the regular terrorism that Israel faces, America faces, is not one that is capable, it's not an existential threat. It's terrible, it's painful, but it's not an existential threat. But it is. And the existential threat that terrorism presents to any open society, any democratic society, is exactly creating a deterioration in the values that society holds. And I'm telling you, since the day that the Second Intifada broke in November 2000, and throughout the years that came since, I litigated cases against the policy of assassinations, or targeted killings, or preventive liquidations. There's always a euphemism. I litigated cases against house demolitions for families of suspected terrorists. I'm a fierce opposer of the massive use of administrative detentions. And all these things are changing our society and its core values to the point that enable what is happening now in Israel, when B'Tselem and Breaking the Silence and myself are seen as traitors and legislation is being brought, a tsunami of bills to start to limit and restrict the freedom of expression and our operation. This exactly how terrorism can win. So I'm also, not also, I'm at the forefront of the fight against terrorism.
So very quickly, before we open up to other questions, can you speak a little bit more about this security establishment that you brought up, how the court often defers to the security arguments that these targeted assassinations or these home demolitions are necessary for security interests, and how do you as a human rights lawyer assess sometimes where you think those security arguments are exaggerated or where they might be more legitimate, and how does that affect your decisions to lawyer cases or not?
The security argument is one of the most elastic materials in the world. You can actually use it in so many ways, in so many fashions. In the jurisprudence on the separation barrier, we have found that in one case, the argument was that the route was chosen because it moves along the top of the hill, which is important because this is the strategic place where you can look and see the area. In another case, they said that actually the security demands that the route would go on 2/3 of the height so that no one could shoot them from behind. And then on a third case, they said that down in the valley, that's the most important place, that's where the route should be. There was, I mean, security argument is, and by the way, one of the terrible things that the generals are doing with the security argument, that they undermine the security argument by contradicting themselves time and again. The problem is that judges, and again, I'm sympathetic to their problem, but I'm still don't accept that they succumb to this. They were appointed to be brave. They fear. Maybe I think the biggest paranoia, not paranoia, the biggest phobia, that's the word, that judges have is that they rule against a certain security measure, and later on something really bad happens, and they will be blamed for the bloodshed or. And again, I can be sympathetic to that. People with uniform and stars come to court and explain to you in a very baritone voice, this is what we need to secure the lives of Israelis. Now, even if logically it doesn't add up, still the easy thing to do is to accept it. While vice versa is not the case. There is no judge that has ever been proved wrong when he allowed house demolition. How can you prove that this house demolition did not prevent future attacks on Israelis? How can you prove that a certain individual that was detained administratively without any charges was actually wrongly detained when the information on why he or she were detained is secret and stays secret for 70 years. So you have the judge in this position where only one decision can be proved wrong. And that is a very bad starting point for lawyers.
You have been listening to a conversation with Israeli human rights attorney Michael Svard, speaking at Harvard University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.